This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
For this month's Job Bite, I'm interviewing a second-year PhD student here at the John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics, Peter Schemmel. Welcome.
Hi, Mark.
So what you're working on is something that I'm finding really interesting because it could be applicable to a lot of astronomy, and it's all about the orbital angular momentum of light. So that's something that I'm not too familiar with. Possibly some of the listeners won't be. So if we sort of take it one thing at a time, what do we mean by orbital angular momentum?
Well, to start off, normally when you're in grade school, you learn that light goes from point A to B in a straight line. And that works really well for most things. Even in complicated research, people can use that approximation all the time. Later on, you find out when you go to university or college that light can also spin. So you can think of it as like a ball rolling on the ground. If I kick a football to you, it's going in a straight line, but it's also rolling, and so it's spinning. That's called spin angular momentum. Now, light can also have something called orbital angular momentum. Now, orbital, you can kind of think of the Earth orbiting around the sun. So it can spin on its axis, or spin, and it can also orbit. So if light has orbital angular momentum, what is actually happening is the light is orbiting its own propagation axis, which means that as it's going from point A to B, it's also moving in a helix.
Imagine it like a corkscrew. Is that the kind of...
Exactly. Yeah, just like a corkscrew. Some other examples are like a spiral slide at a playground. That would be a single helix, or we would call it a mode 1 OAM.
OAM is orbital...
Orbital angular momentum.
Okay. Yes.
A mode 2... would be a double helix, and the most famous double helix is DNA. Mm-hmm. So you can think of, if you've seen pictures of DNA and that twisting motion, that's what a mode 2 OAM wave would look like. Now there's also my favorite, which is a mode 3, and that might sound a bit exotic, a triple helix, but we actually see them every time you go to the grocery store, and that's fusilli pasta. Or rotini, as Americans call it.
Okay, yeah.
So that's actually a mode 3 helix, or a mode 3 OAM wave. And so you can look at that wave, and it's like this corkscrewing kind of plane altogether. Mm-hmm. And that's what an OAM mode 3 looks like.
Wow. So how can we tell that these modes of OAM actually exist?
Well, we know that OAM actually exists for two reasons. The first one is that we can measure it and we can make it in the lab. But the second one is it comes straight out of Maxwell's equations.
The equations that describe how light propagates.
Exactly. Right. And so if you do some complicated mathematics, not just your normal deriving the waves and everything like that, but if you look at actually how the momentum moves in the equations, you can actually find that these higher order modes have an orbital angular momentum component. And the interesting thing was that people knew that it could exist from these equations, and we knew that other particles could have orbital angular momentum, like electrons in an atom, but we really couldn't experimentally show that light or photons could have orbital angular momentum until around 1992, when a group from the Netherlands ended up finding out that not only could light have orbital angular momentum, but that it was also quantized. Now, that means that the orbital angular momentum states that the light has can only be integer numbers, so minus 1, plus 1, plus 10, minus 10. But you can't have numbers like 1.5 or 3.3. Those aren't allowed.
So that's something like in quantum theory with atoms that, or electrons in atoms have certain states.
Exactly, right. And so the way we actually can make this in the lab, or the ways that we can actually measure it in the lab, I should say, is that we actually look at the intensity and phase structure of these waves. Now, a normal intensity pattern looks kind of like a Gaussian shape. It's nice and smooth, and it has a little bit of a hump in the middle, and then it tapers out at the end. An OAM wave looks a bit like a donut, so it has a big hole in the middle, so we can look for that. But a lot of things can make holes in the middle of the waves. So the better way to look for it is to measure the phase. And phase is just a fancy word that physicists use for position on the wave. And so what we look for is we measure the phase and we look for these phase dislocations or these cuts in the wave. And those come from the helical structure of the wave. So a mode 1 OAM, so if you think about the spiral slide, would have one dislocation. A mode 2, or a double helix like DNA, would have two dislocations. And we can measure the phase and we can count the number of dislocations and we can visually see what the mode number of the wave is. So a mode 3 OAM beam would have three dislocations and so on.
And the light that's sort of around us now, let's say, is that likely to mostly be what you'd call a mode 0 of OAM?
Right.
Or will there be some little bits of the other modes?
You can what's called decompose light into all different kinds of modes. And it turns out that a lot of it is mode 0, or it has 0 OAM. And that's the most common. But there can be little bits of light that have more OAM or less OAM than mode 0. And so what we're trying to do is make devices that we can put on telescopes that filter out all the mode 0 and leave only the little bit of mode 1 or 2 or minus 1 and minus 2 behind. That way we can visually see that and filter out all the rest. So it's kind of like making a special pair of glasses.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm thinking of an analogy now to like the polarization of light. So we use that all the time in 3D cinemas and 3D TV now, don't we?
Sure, sure.
And it's a similar sort of thing, only it's sort of an extra step of complexity, I guess.
Right,
but
right.
The equipment that you're making, what kind of frequencies of light does that work at? Could I put it on the Lovell telescope and use it for radio observations?
Actually, we're hoping to do that at some point in time. The interesting thing, or the great thing about OAM, is that you can detect it at any frequency, because this comes from Maxwell's equations. So anything that Maxwell's equations describe can have OAM. A lot of people work in optical wavelengths, and people have done quite a lot of work with OAM in optical wavelengths. They've done things for optical trapping of particles and getting them to spin in circles or drive little gears in nanomachines, for example.
Wow.
But we like to work at 100 gigahertz, so a lower frequency, but pretty high for radio, which is normally around 1 gigahertz, 10 maybe, something like that. And the reason we work at 100 gigahertz is because we can make the devices to convert these OAM states from mode 0 to mode 1 or 2 and vice versa out of plastics that we can buy cheaply, and they don't have too big of a size and they're not too massive or too heavy. So it just makes machining them, the components and making the waves much easier. But if we wanted to go to a lower frequency, like at the level, we'd have to make it much bigger, but it would still work the exact same way that we do today.
Okay. And I guess as an astronomer, the question I'd be really interested in is if we were able to start picking up these OAM modes in the photons that we're receiving from things in the universe, what could we possibly learn about different astrophysical phenomena? I know that's a huge question, but it would be a whole
that's
extra dimension of information,
question.
Wouldn't it?
Yes, that's a very tricky question. The real answer is that if I knew what we could find out, there wouldn't be much point in doing it, now, would there be?
Okay.
But to be fair, a lot of people have some ideas about what we could see. And some of them in the radio regime are light from rotating black holes. So as a black hole is rotating, it's twisting space-time. And that twisting space-time is giving orbital angular momentum to light as it passes through or comes out of the accretion disk. So you could measure it from that. You could also measure it from masers or dust or stars. There's all kinds of processes that can theoretically make OAM. Now, no one's really measured it from outer space yet. And so that provides a bit of a challenge to us because we don't really know if there's going to be OAM coming from it. Even if there is, are we able to measure it? Is the signal too low? Is the beam too big? There's a lot of tricky bits with measuring OAM compared to a normal bit of radiation. And that's because the OAM beams have that big hole in the middle. And so normally for a mode zero beam, you can look at a very little tiny piece, and it doesn't matter where on the beam you look, you'll be able to pick up radiation. But for OAM, we have to see the entire beam, or at least the very inner portion. But there's a big intensity dip there, which means that we don't have a lot of power, which means that our equipment needs to be very, very sensitive in order to pick up a signal. So it's very difficult to see these things, even if they're there. We just might not know it.
Okay. Well, it sounds like it's something that could come along in the future. Maybe there'll be a telescope with an OAM receiver on it, a radio telescope.
We're hoping so. We're hoping so. People have seen them in the atmosphere, actually, and the atmosphere actually is made up of multiple layers in a simplified model, and they have a bit of turbulence to them, so a bit of random distribution in the layer density and spacing and things like that. And people at the United States Air Force have actually been working on tracking these OAM photons coming from the atmosphere, and they've been able to measure the number of atmospheric layers and the relative velocity of those layers to each other. So OAM can be made in nature. We've seen that through these experiments or measurements, and they can be used to do relevant measurements in physical terms. So we're hoping that we can take that and move to bigger systems out in space and learn new information and things like that.
Wow, that's brilliant. It's always great for astronomers to find out there's a bit more information in the photons they're picking up.
Absolutely.
I'm looking forward to seeing those on some telescopes one day. Thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime, Mark.